My name's Nigel Fellows Freeman, and I am the founder and CEO of Canopy, and I'm the host today of Building Tomorrow's Insurer. We generally, day to day, I have a bunch of conversations with really interesting folks across the industry. And what we're trying to do with the podcast here is bring those people together, learn from them, learn from their experiences, and share their wealth of knowledge with the rest of the industry. And I am very, very happy to say that today in episode 7, we've got Nick Proud joining us, who is one of the VCs at InsurTech Gateway Australia, helping kind of fund the kind of next generation of startups in Australia. He's well known across the industry. He's got, I think, kind of 15 years of kind of financial services experience, kind of in corporate and finance, M&A strategy, and a bunch of product roles. And so really, really excited to have you today, Nick. Thanks for being here. I'm really looking
Thanks
forward to the
me.
Conversation.
Yeah, me too.
It's, I think just touching there, like the breadth of roles, we'll just jump straight in, the breadth of roles you've had spanning kind of corporate finance, M&A, and products, obviously they're kind of all the big pieces that I know kind of founders and young companies think about a bunch. And so can you maybe just give me a sense of kind of, yeah, your transition through those roles and kind of how you ended up in VC?
Yeah, sure. I have done quite a few different things, which, you know, sometimes you're starting from scratch, but sometimes that's a good thing. Hopefully it has been for me along the way. But yeah, when I was in my early 20s at uni, finished up, and I always liked stock markets and, you know, the moving beast that is whatever those companies that are trading. So worked at a small Brisbane firm for a few years in different areas, in the managed funds area and then on the trading desk. But I kind of got to a point where in my mid-20s, I didn't have much real world experience, and I was managing all these, you know, people getting close to retirement, their wealth. So I thought it's time to go out and work in some of these companies that we were looking at and get some of that real experience of being decision makers and not just looking at what the share price is worth and its up and downs throughout the day. So yeah, I went and worked in a big Brazilian mining company for a number of years when they were setting up their shop in Australia. So it was big capital intensive business, lots of investment decisions and different ways of assessing and lots of moving parts of that. And that was really exciting. We were buying a lot of mines, and then the coal mining boom sort of tailed off. So my job became from buying mines to selling mines. And we did that successfully and put myself out of a job, basically, by doing that. So then went and worked for a small bank for a few years and sort of ran the strategy for that. And then part of that was merging into what is RACQ, the Queensland-based motor insurer, and yeah, then stayed with there for a bit and ran all the bank products through that and the strategy as well. And then, yeah, was lucky enough to meet the Envest crew here in Brisbane who had met the UK Gateway team and Simon O'Dell, who's my business partner here. And yeah, we just got on really well and kind of just went from there. And that was almost 4 years ago now. Feels like not that long, but that's where we are now.
Super interesting. Winding back a little bit into that, those mining days, how did the kind of investment of capital when at a mining company, like that kind of super capital intensive type of business, like, is there any kind of parallels you draw with that in like kind of now VC world and looking at insurtech startups? Like, how would like kind of deployment of capital and how you thought about it there and you think about it today, kind of similarities, massively different?
I think that there are some similarities. At the end of the day, people are investing capital to get a return, so that's number one, and that's the decisions. But yeah, if I think about, you know, it was $5 billion was getting spent on some of these mines. If I think about some of the businesses, you know, even like yourself, imagine what you could do with that money. It could do some pretty cool stuff. Whereas with those mines, because there's so much equipment that was needed to be spent, you know, in the capital up front, that's why the zeros just kept adding up. Whereas, you know, in the space we're working in these days with software, it's more about getting people and software building that, which is much more scalable. And that's probably the big difference. So these mines, you spend a couple of $100 million and it's a very defined area. There's a seam of coal that you're basically trying to get out of the ground in an efficient way. Whereas, you know, in software, if you build something, particularly with SaaS that we see these days, a user can be anywhere in the globe as long as you've got some internet connectivity and a computer, then that's scalability. That's the very different thing. And, you know, if you invest a dollar in a mine, you might get a dollar five back. Whereas if you put a dollar into a tech business, you know, if you pick a good one, you can turn that into $100 potentially. So that's probably the biggest difference. And yeah, it's, I guess the mining is really tangible, very defined. Whereas, you know, with software, it's much more, I guess it can be anything and you can change it very quickly. Whereas that, those coal seams, they've been there for millions of years or whatever it is. And that's all there is that's there.
Yeah, super interesting. I saw, reading some stuff around the kind of autonomous vehicles. Obviously, they're a really good test bed, aren't they? I guess mines for autonomous vehicles, because obviously they do a bunch of these big trucks to go back to some Fords, and they've got a bunch of autonomy in there. I'm sure we're learning a lot from that space.
Yeah, well, the those trucks that are in the Pilbara are getting driven by people in Perth Airport, so they're a long way away. Whereas, you know, in the past they were literally sitting in the trucks. Yeah.
Well, usually, obviously, kind of InsurTech Gateway today, and kind of obviously an incubator program here in Australia. Kind of interested in just understanding a little bit more about the program itself. I'm sure there's a bunch of startups here listening that maybe seen the name, kind of are interested in the space, but always good to hear from the horse's mouth around the actual incubator program and how it kind of functions.
Yeah, sure. So we started in the UK as InsurTech Gateway 2016, and we set up here in Australia 2019. But the idea and where it spawned from was there's such big barriers to entry to insurance, and we set up what we do to try and help break some of them down for founders. So most of the founders within our portfolio here in the UK are not from insurance. So we like to find people who, you know, they might have deep domain expertise in something else, and then we help bring that insurance element to what they're doing. And you know, there's lots of accelerators and incubators out there in the market that many of them do more of a cohort-based approach. So they might get 50 smart people in a room, have a very set program. Ours is quite different to that by design. So we're low volume but higher touch. So here in Australia, we typically back two, potentially three startups per year, and we get really hands-on with them. So back on my point about the breaking down barriers, so we've got our own AFSL that if the startup that we're working with needs to be regulated, we can do that. So they can apply for their own license at the right time rather than having to do it up front. And the idea there really is about speed to market and doing things efficiently, which is really at the core of our DNA. And we sit down when we get to know founders and we work through what the needs of their business is, and then we lean in to focus on that. So, you know, if there's things like, if they're not regulated, we don't need to talk about the AFSL or compliance regime, and we'll focus on building that product and the scalability, or if it's distribution, what it might be. So yeah, we really spend time getting to know the business and what their growth plans are and where we can lean in and help. So a lot of that is insurance focused, but it's also, you know, we help build startups. So it can be more general business advice, like helping with your cap table, making sure that you're not putting things in place now that you're going to have to unpick down the track, because at the end of the day, that can cause more harm than good. And we don't force it, but often we'll sit on the board of the startup for that, because typically we're the first institutional investor for most of the startups that we back. We sort of sit on that investor director seat and make sure that they've got that view of, because you're always thinking about that next capital round and making sure things are in the right shape for when people come in and look at it. Because if you don't think about it until that time, then it can be too late. So it's about, yeah, I guess, thinking forward and helping the founders do what they're good at, and then we lean in and help out the other parts of the business.
And thematically, I think when I look globally, there's been a little shift thematically in most of the accelerators, incubators, and specific funds focus on InsurTech, has been a bit of a thematic shift away from maybe just distribution plays, and it seems like there's more like adjacency plays in terms of thinking about maybe lower down in the value chain, in, well, I say lower down, like towards the bottom in terms of back-end systems and data and those kind of adjacencies versus just the distribution plays that maybe came out the gate first. Are you seeing that as well? Is that like a thought from, do you have around like thematics?
Yeah, we do. Some of the you know, the more thinking from a couple of years ago was these insurtechs are standing up products to compete against the existing incumbents and, you know, more taking market share from them. Whereas where we're looking now is where can these startups innovate and create new risk transfer mechanisms or pools of risk? Because, you know, if you think about the year, you know, we're in 2023, there's new and emerging risks all the time, whether it's climate change related or cybersecurity. Every week there seems to be new ones. And the traditional or the incumbent world aren't necessarily geared up to help or factor in the risk transfer for those new risks. So, yeah, we really like meeting founders who might be a climate scientist who can look at those risks in a different way and stand up a technology or a platform that can help with that risk transfer. But it's also, and we're seeing more and more of a focus of not just transferring risk, but it's about prevention and mitigation as well. Because, you know, at the end of the day, these big cyclones or NatCat events that are coming and getting bigger and worse, let's not just deal with them after the fact. You can do things in advance to try and lessen the impact of them. And there's huge opportunities for InsurTechs to be able to do that, particularly from a data perspective.
Interesting. Nick, when you're kind of looking globally, I think thematically it seems that the accelerators, the incubators, and obviously the insurance-specific VCs have seemed to be investing a little bit more broadly in terms of adjacencies around insurance, whether that's kind of different parts of the value stack, whether that's kind of more kind of data aggregation platforms, a bunch of different things, and are moving away from straight distribution plays and MGAs. Like, are you seeing that here in Australia? Are you seeing that kind of that trend in terms of inbound stuff coming to you and kind of thematically how you're thinking about investing?
Yeah, we do, and we are. There's, you know, many players in InsurTech do naturally think of the MGA model, and that's kind of the classic InsurTech, and that's where it spawned from. They were traditionally competing against the big incumbents of the world for that premium pool, so it wasn't really expanding the premium pool itself. Whereas, yeah, we like to meet and see founders who can create new ways of assessing risk or adhering to those new risks that are emerging in the world that we're facing every day at the moment. Whether it's climate change related, it could be cybersecurity, these different threats that society faces. Having these people and founders who might have a unique data set that are actually able to facilitate that risk transfer on those new risks, that's what the incumbents aren't geared up to do. But it's also, we're definitely seeing a move towards not just dealing with after the fact when an event happens, but it's a lot about prevention and mitigation. So, yeah, we might meet a climate scientist who has spent they might have a PhD in a specific element of climate science, and then they can assess and help frame up what that risk might be, and as I said, not just deal with it after that risk happens, an event, it's working out how can they prevent or mitigate it happening or lessen the impact of it. So they're the opportunities that we see for InsurTechs themselves, and, you know, whether it's data providers, platforms, you know, like yourselves, that there's a big place for that, because as we all know, the incumbents have this legacy technology that is just not set up to do any of these changes quickly, and they have to spend so much money to get it into that shape. Whereas, you know, a startup, you can spend probably 5% of it and get much better results.
Yeah, totally. I think there's a really interesting kind of concept there, which is kind of creating new premium pools. And I think obviously you're the bunch of the embedded stuff like at Assam and Torrance, etc., talk about around these kind of the protection gap and that doubling over the last 20 years, and that's really the accessibility to products that people don't have today. And so, A, how do you kind of give them the access to the product? And B, how do you create the product that services that customer? which is kind of what you're talking about, and then there's risk pools. I think those two things coming together, like where you will create super interesting businesses over time. And maybe a little bit of an extension to that, which is, I think we're starting to see some M&A. We're starting to see some consolidation, I think, of some startups that may be raised and haven't quite hit exit trajectory, I suppose, in terms of kind of trying to hit the numbers they need to hit. And so I get a sense of maybe some consolidation through this year and next, and a bunch of M&A, whether that's kind of startup to startup or whether that's kind of insurer to startup. Have you got a sense of that? How is that? Is that coming up in any conversations you're having? Just interested in what you're seeing on the ground.
Yeah, if we think back to 2021, the startup funding was crazy. That was a bubble. A lot of people use that as their reference point, but if you strip that out, and obviously 2022 and now, it's a much different landscape. But if you look at historical trends, it's not that much below where the trend line would be. So I think people just got used to 2021 and enjoyed it. And, founders, many of them did well raising money, but a lot of their runways will be coming up or soon coming to an end, and they're going to need to raise money. And so we're starting to see more down rounds happening, which, is any existing shareholder's worst nightmare. And that has to be dealt with. And there's a lot of activity more in sort of convertible notes. Safes seem to be getting more prevalence as well. Some investors won't touch them, and that's fine. If you're not putting a price on your business right now, if you can get away with that, then potentially that's a good thing. Because the investment that people took back whenever it was in the last 18 months or so, that was to get your business to the next point. If you're not there, it's hard to go back and ask for more money, because people, it's pretty clear, whether it's milestones or numbers. And from an M&A perspective, I think this year that we'll see more and more of that. So the last couple of years, it's been more about VCs and investors coming in and raising new capital for startups. There hasn't been a lot of consolidation. I think we'll see some of that this year. Where it comes from, I'm not too sure. I think there'll be some good opportunities for, some of the banks or the insurers out there who can just buy these startups and buy the innovation, and hopefully that they can do some integration for it and not just kill it when they bring it internally. There's a lot to play out, I think. There is a lot of capital out there that wants to find a home. I think investors are just being more cautious with it and not fighting each other over term sheets and skipping the whole due diligence process.
Yeah, watch this space for sure. Changing gears a little bit, and I think part of the thing that we see reasonably regularly in lots of the conferences and things we go to, I'm sure you're there too, is this kind of direct insurer-broker kind of conflict. And kind of my view is that they can all live very harmoniously, and the market is easily big enough with you and all having the right value props to deliver different things to customers. But have you got a sense of how an archetype being kind of like embedded versus kind of broker, have you got a sense of like how you think the broker model will evolve, or any kind of changes that you might see in the broker space?
Yeah, I think to my mind brokers will always play a part, but maybe not so in some product lines specifically. But at the end of the day, risks and finding a home to place that risk can be very complicated, particularly if you look at small business or more commercial insurance, and that's where brokers do most of their work. The way I see brokers, I think their role, their day-to-day operations will change. So at the moment, a broker's out there finding clients and then getting to know their needs and servicing them. A lot of time and effort is spent on more of the admin. So, filling out proposal forms and shopping that around. I think, AI, the buzzword at the moment, there's a lot of technology out there that can help automate a lot of that. So, data collection, brokers are salespeople. Salespeople don't typically like data and doing admin things. They don't really go together. So let the brokers be the salespeople and out there doing their business development activities. And there's lots of technologies that are emerging or even exist now that can do a lot of that heavy lifting in the background. And that frees up the brokers to do, one, what they like and what they're good at. And, you know, maybe there's some cross-sell product opportunities more in the personal line space that can be automated as well to that. And that can help brokers service their customers better, but again, not being distracting from what they're doing.
I think that's a really good call. I think you just kind of talk about kind of that selling piece. That selling plus advice, right, is kind of where they're great. Like, and they've generally got really deep knowledge, deep domain experience. They've been written a lot of business over time and understand a lot of risks. And I think you're right. I think they're starting to grow there in terms of the tooling available for brokers. I actually did some research with some brokers a few weeks ago, and I sat down with them and just to watch kind of how their day ran, and they had like 15 different tabs open, and like they'd be copying different, like the same information to different tabs. There was a bunch, like you say, like an administration work. I think there's a bunch of efficiencies I think that could go in there, but I would say that also
it's even just rekeying into the same data into systems over and over. It doesn't make sense, and surely that can be fixed pretty easily, you'd think.
Yeah. I think obviously Bold Penguin did a great job at that kind of in the US, and they kind of took that approach of single, like, and obviously there's folks like kind of Sunrise and SVU, those kind of like those platforms here in Australia, and tried to solve some of that, but I guess they don't solve the full problem, and so they generally have multiples of those open all at once. And so I still think there's some of that efficiency stuff that can be worked on, but I think you're right. I think the position of the broker over time is one of how can you kind of supercharge them and get them to focus on all the stuff that they're great at, which is that advice piece. And I think you're right, that kind of SME to commercial makes a bunch of sense. If you kind of think of, you play that forward and you kind of play it forward to 2030, and we think about kind of insurance being kind of delivered in 2030, how do you've got a sense of kind of how you think the insurance industry is going to kind of, if we think about that future insurer, what it's going to look like by 2030? You've got a sense of, if you were to transport yourself there, what you think it might look like?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had a crystal ball and knew the answer, because we could be dealing with that right now. But I think insurance is based on a lot of data, and there's so much data out there that isn't being utilized. So I think insurers across the globe know that they've got a lot of data, but how can they utilize it in the best way? I think there'll be a lot of focus on that. And even simple things like you go and get a quote for your home insurance, rather than the insurer asking me, has my house flooded ever? There's other data that they can get that, and they should know the answer first, and you just type the address and it should pull it. So I think structuring data and databases is one way that hopefully there will be some big leaps made. A lot of the back end, as a, for brokers, even the rekeying and a lot of that administration that everyone brings it up at the moment, the whole chat GPT and all those sort of things, those large language models. I think there's a lot of the AI technologies that will be able to streamline a lot of those things, and that can benefit the insurer, and that can make they have more margins. But at the end of the day, they can't have too much profit taking. So hopefully consumers can benefit as well, by whether it's cost savings or better products that can be invested in. Insurance is a grudge purchase, and I think people realize that they do need it in many ways, but there are new risks emerging as well that people potentially need to be educated on as well. And if there is a product that can help solve that problem, then let's invest in that. Let's get it out there and help people, because 2023, what is that, 7 years away? There'll be some big changes in society that'll happen over that time, and the risk landscape I think will be very different. And we probably won't have flying cars in that time, but cars will be different. There'll be more of that autonomous driving around in society, and so motor insurance will change dramatically. Houses are changing the way people live, more broadly with climate change happening. It's some people say global warming, but it's climate change. It does get colder, it gets hotter, there's bigger events. So people or insurers need to factor that in, and how they do that, I think that's where a lot of energy is going to be spent over the next few years.
I caught up with one of the membership, the driving membership insurers, and their almost number one focus was understanding that their current auto book will likely go to zero or near to zero, and so how do they kind of think about that? And that's just a super interesting concept, right? Which is almost like innovator's dilemma, but in a way not, because it's just happening, and so you're not disrupting yourself, it's just happening, and so you have to try and reimagine. So I think I agree, it's going to be very, very interesting on that piece around data, because I think really hit a nail there. And I haven't quite interested in your thoughts. I'm not sure kind of how I feel about this today. I think there's an opportunity, but I'm not sure how it's going to roll through, which is open insurance. And so obviously we've seen open banking kind of do its thing in the UK and start to hit some scale, but obviously not kind of hasn't massively scaled up yet. And obviously here kind of it took a while and maybe hasn't kind of maybe given the use cases yet. And so have you got a sense of, how do you think open insurance here is going to play through? Is it going to be a long time? You've got any kind of use cases in mind?
Yeah, I think it's coming, but I think it's going to take a lot longer and a lot more effort than potentially the regulators or the industry acknowledges. You're right, open banking, it's here. Has it done much for us yet? I don't know. As a consumer, I haven't really seen any benefit of it yet. And part of that, and this is the skeptic in me, but it's the bigger players who can help expedite it. They're being more defensive because they're the ones who've got more to lose from opening it up. So I think forcing them to do more in some way is a way to do it, but I don't know how that can be done. For use cases, again, I think that's where the everyday consumer, that data piece that I was talking about and having that portability of it, it should make it easier for them to go and get other quotes and get better coverage or better prices, whatever it is. But again, if I'm the big insurer who's got the big book, why am I going to facilitate that? Because it's just going to help the smaller competitors come and eat my customer base. So there's quite a divergence of solutions and problems and who wants to get involved in what. The energy retailers are getting involved in it. I don't think they want to do it either. There's just a reluctance to do a lot of this from the big end of town. And I get that. And I'd be the same if I was there. So I think it's trying to find a way that can benefit everyone involved. I don't have the answer. It's going to take longer than people, I think, hope or expect.
I think, maybe just a very kind of operational example, and I know obviously the banks struggle with this a little bit, and that's just exposing the data. If we think about you and I know the kind of large insurers pretty well, and we know how many policy management systems they all have, it's generally in the teens. And so how do they then build APIs to expose all of those books? And there's just a real operational, it's just going to be hard. And if they're going to get forced to do it, they have to spend the money, it'll get done. I just think it'll be hard and it'll take time. On the other side, I think there's some wonderful use cases and the value, and that I suppose the important piece, which is all the kind of research coming out of the UK, which says a customer that sees extra value and whether that's an improved service, a cheaper service, whatever it is happy to share their data. So I think the consumer's saying they'll want it, and it's just kind of fixing that middle part of exposing it, I think, will be the bit that takes some time.
Yeah, I agree. And people are protective of their personal data, which I am too. And you see these cybersecurity breaches, with Medibank and Optus and things like that. There's a good reason why people are protective of it. So like you say, people will offer it up if they get value, and there is some, robust security over it as well.
Pivoting back to kind of VC and investment land a little bit, have you got any trends that you're investing trends through 2023, 2024? I know we spoke a little bit earlier on around kind of some things that sit around insurance, but is there any kind of, ag or climate, or is there any kind of specific themes and trends that you're seeing being invested in?
Yeah. There's a few buzzwords that are floating around at the moment, and for good reasons, because they are emerging technology. So, the whole artificial intelligence space is it's super hot. The last business that we invested in was the middle of last year. They're an artificial intelligence business, so
ahead of the curve, Nick.
Yeah, well, in some ways, maybe, but whether it was by design or not, I don't know. But these guys, for example, we met them and we were just super impressed because they'd been doing AI since before it was really a thing. I think there's a lot of people or startups that have just sort of simmered to the surface because AI is the hot thing and it's where all the investment money's going, and that's fine. Some of them will succeed. I think it's becoming a crowded space already. Climate is definitely another one where, you know, society's feeling the pain of climate change and the impacts of it. So this whole climate tech space, you know, that's emerging and it's really flourishing here locally, there's a need for it. So I think, again, it's a good thing and there's a lot of money going to it. I think sometimes, you know, you talk about ESG and things like that, sometimes it can get, the reporting element of it can overshadow the problem solving nature of it. So again, similar with claims and dealing after the fact, ESG can focus on after the fact. Why not we shift the balance to more dealing with how to be proactive about it? And there's a lot of great startups that are starting to emerge in that space of, I think at the end of the day, that as long as these startups are focusing on solving a problem, then they should succeed. Whereas if they're just trying to latch onto a buzzword, I don't think that's not sustainable. And yeah, ag tech is another one as well. Last year, I spent a couple of days up in Toowoomba because I'm based in Brisbane and getting to know some of the players there. And you've got farmers, these tech businesses, government. There's a lot of key players involved and a lot of money. And, you know, there's a growing population. We've got the finite amount of resources that we can feed the world. So big opportunity there as well. And where we like to get involved, you know, we're insurance-specific investors. So we look at where insurance can play a part with some of these businesses. And if there's an asset involved, insurance is part of it. But we like to try and get a bit creative on how insurance can help. And potentially it can be with, you know, might be a business that has some technology, but insurance can help build a business model to apply to that technology. And that's where, yeah, we spend a lot of time trying to work with founders on how that can come to fruition.
You spoke in there about like kind of different kind of actors being kind of government, farmers and tech. On that side, or the other side being kind of insurers, or maybe more of a corporate blanket, like corporate with small businesses. Obviously, yep. You're kind of like working like very closely with a bunch of startups and have really good links into the corporates, I guess, built over time. Is there anything that you've seen been really effective in being able to foster those partnerships, and anything that you've seem really work really well, or things that are like things you would avoid doing if you're like a startup listening to this and trying to build some relationships with these government entities or corporates? Have you got any kind of thoughts on kind of how they should approach it?
Yeah, I've got plenty. So when you're dealing with the big end of town, things take time. So don't put all your eggs in one basket, because, you know, it might take 9 months to realize that it's not going to happen. So I think hedging your bets, and if you're going to work with the big end of town, whoever it might be, try and get some smaller customers as well, because they can get the pace going and then you've got a good feedback loop as well. But where we've seen some really interesting things happen from a partnership perspective is, rather than a startup pitching to whether it's an incumbent or whoever it is, it's more of a reverse pitch. So, you know, there might be a reinsurer who's got an acute problem that they've identified. It's really good when they realize that doing it internally is not going to be the right way. So they might put out a reverse pitch and get a whole bunch of startups to put their ideas in mind to how they would go and solve it. And I think we've seen a couple of instances where that's been really successful, both for the incumbent, but also the startup, because they're getting some really good traction for a problem that is acute and is needed right now. When startups are trying to solution-led, that's where you can end up in a bad spot, because you need to make sure that there are customer needs being solved. And if there's not, then, you know, you can get caught up in your own day-to-day, what you're working on. But if you're not solving a problem or with a customer need, then, you know, you're just fighting an uphill battle that you can't do forever.
Yeah, the solution and enterprise solution-led enterprise sale is why Salesforce are very good, but they've got thousands of BDs, thousands of architects, thousands of engineers building kind of solutions for every problem. So I think that's good advice. If you're going to continue to I know we kind of play 2030 out, and I've got a, I guess we've got a here Canopy kind of view of how can kind of we have default insurance, or how can insurance be attached to the things that we interact with or that we purchase, and kind of you have this kind of risk profile that follows you around, and you kind of protect it for the things that you want. And I always kind of get excited and optimistic and think this is going to happen by 2030, but I think the reality is it's probably 2050. And so have you got any kind of sense of what 2050 would look like for you in terms of any specific things right out in the future that you think you could wave a wand what it might look like?
Yeah, I think, at the moment we're sitting where you've got the incumbent insurance industry and then you've got the insurtech space. I think, I hope by 2050 they're not delineated and it's basically just the one thing. And because if insurers by then aren't still tech focused, then I don't know if they'll still be around or not. And it, potentially it'll get to the point where they're just a balance sheet that can sit there and support all these other businesses that can sit on top of them. And I think that's probably not a bad thing, because there's some pretty strong balance sheets out there with, maybe not the best ways of going about doing business going forward. But yeah, by 2050, we know that the world will be a very different place, and incumbents are not great at change themselves. They go at a glacial pace. So I think if I look at some of the stats with insurtech funding globally from 2021, that top of year, it was $15 billion. The insurance market is $6 trillion per year. So if you think of insurtech as the R&D function of insurance, it's less than 1% of the annual turnover. So I'd like to see that, that can grow a lot. And at the end of the day, insurers are here to help society. They're here to help their shareholders get returns as well. But why insurance existed in the first place was to protect people in times of loss or whatever incidents might occur. So insurance plays such a critical part in society that it needs to evolve with society at the same time.
That is very articulately put, Nick.
Thank you.
I think that's...
And hopefully I'm on a beach by 2050, retired on a beach somewhere. So that's the plan.
On a beach. With your sailing boat protected. Nick, thank you so much for everything today. If there are any startups out there that are looking or that kind of want to chat to somebody who knows a bunch, and I know Nick will always do that. And so, Nick, thanks for your time. Thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.